You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, who still wants to go out and see a movie? Ticket sales in 2021 outpaced those from the year before, but they were still a massive 70% down from 2019. Jen White looks at what lies ahead for the movie business. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, what do you remember about the last time you had to perform under pressure? Maybe your heart started racing, you got butterflies in your stomach. Maybe the whole experience went so badly you decided you'd never do it again. Our next guest says not so fast. He says you can build your confidence with deliberate work and by changing the way you think. And he has lessons from the U.S. military, pro sports, and the business world to back it up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When do you find yourself struggling with your self-confidence? What does that little voice in your head say when you're under pressure? When you make a mistake in whatever your job or hobby is, does it haunt you or do you find ways to learn from it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nate Zinser is the director of the Performance Psychology Program at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. His new book is titled The Confident Mind, A Battle-Tested Guide to Unshakable Performance. Nate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you so much for the invite.
Before we get to what confidence is, you clear up a lot of misconceptions about what it isn't. And I think one thing I might have thought was confidence is a personality trait. You have it or you don't, and you can't do anything about it. Not true, right?
Not true in my experience. Confidence is a skill that you learn, that you develop, just the same way you might develop a good tennis backhand or a good foul shot or a good speech about a topic that you've been studying for years. It's a skill. You can build it, you can let it go, but you can build it up and get it to a point where it's very functional when you need it.
You have your own definition of confidence. Can you share it with us?
Certainly. Most definitions for confidence are rather abstract because I work in the world of, you know, functional human performance. I have developed a very functional definition, and it goes like this. Confidence is the sense of certainty that you have about a skill or an ability that allows you to perform that skill or ability pretty much without thinking about how you do it while you are doing it. It's more or less automatic, more or less second nature.
All right, a sense of certainty about my ability. Now, does that mean if I'm not really good at something already, I can't be confident in it?
Not necessarily. You can be as confident as your ability allows. And in some cases, maybe your confidence can outstretch your actual ability, which might not be a bad thing in some contexts.
You've worked with a lot of pro athletes. And something I wonder about, and I think about my own job, is, okay, you've just made a big mistake, and lots of people just saw or heard it. My gut instinct, I think a lot of people are going to be like, I got to focus on that mistake and figure out how to not do it again. You say that's exactly the opposite of what that athlete ought to do.
Well, exactly. If you focus on the memory of making a mistake, in a very subtle but powerful way, you encourage your nervous system to repeat it. That's why it's important to think about what you want, the performance that you want to have, the way you want to hit that shot, play that point, contest that point in the negotiation. You have to think about what you want, and that way you actually subtly but importantly encourage your nervous system to do it that way.
One example you gave, and I can't remember which athlete it was, there's one athlete who took their video and edited it. These are my really good plays. These are the ones where I was in the ballpark. These are my mistakes. Three separate files. That mistake file, they deleted.
They deleted, absolutely. You're referring to Hall of Fame baseball hitter Tony Gwynn,
right,
who would deliberately delete the video clips where he swung at a bad pitch because he did not want to remind himself, as he put it, looking like a fool swinging at somebody's curveball. He wanted to hang on to the memory of good hits. He also wanted to hang on to the memory of good decisions that he made at the plate, whether to go after a good pitch or whether to hold off after a bad pitch. But he did not need to hold on to the memory of the poor decisions that he made. So he essentially erase them from his memory.
Talking to Nate Zinser about his new book. It's called The Confident Mind, A Battle-Tested Guide to Unshakable Performance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about confidence and how to build it up for our guest, or maybe an experience yourself in your career, in your athletic days, whether they're long ago or they're going on right now, was there a moment where you became more confident? How did that reflect in your performance? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Nate, suppose I came into your office and said, yeah, I want to improve my confidence. What are the first steps you take people through?
Well, the first thing I have to help people understand is that confidence is a function of how you think. Again, those misconceptions that it's a personality trait. No, confidence really comes down to how you think about yourself and how you think about the things that happen in your game or in your profession. And I have to explain that there is a very important connection between the thoughts that you have, be they memories, be they that voice in your head, be they the pictures that you create through your imagination about possible futures. All those thoughts influence your mood state, your emotional state. And that emotional state really drives bodily changes, changes in your physical nature, blood flow, muscle tension, hormone production, and those physical changes will certainly influence your execution at whatever it is that you do. So once we understand that there's a real power and there's an impact of our conscious, deliberate thoughts as we go along, now we have to be very selective and very careful about those thoughts. So I take people through exercises to manage their memories about their past, to make sure that the stories they're telling themselves about themselves with that inner voice are constructive, and so that they are also using their imagination to picture the things that they want, to picture the positive responses to life's inevitable setbacks. And with the combination of all of those thoughts put together, you can build up that sense of certainty and give yourself an opportunity to be as good as you actually are.
A lot of people might think success leads to confidence. You flip it around and talk about the ways that confidence leads to success. And you quote the ancient Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu to back up your point. Could you spell that out for us?
Certainly. Sun Tzu observed a long time ago that victorious warriors had basically made up their minds that they were going to win, and then they went into battle, where losing warriors did the exact opposite. They went into battle, and once they got in there, they just sort of started hoping to win. There's no denying that confidence can lead to success. There's no denying that success can lead to confidence. It all depends on how you think and how you process your success. If you think that your success was just a lucky fluke and that it really didn't come about due to anything that you did, well, then your success really doesn't help you going forward with your life. If, on the other hand, you are able to look at your success and say, yes, I did that, I put in the work, I made the move, I made the speech, yay me, then at that point, your success is working for you. So again, it's not what happens to you, it's how you think about what happens to you.
Another bit of practical advice. I think we've all been in a situation where we're about to do a thing, the big game, the big broadcast, the big performance, whatever, and you get the butterflies and the nerves. And you say that's not necessarily a bad thing, but we can do something better with it.
It's absolutely not a bad thing. It is just a fact of who we are as human beings. We are designed through our evolution to experience a surge of energy, the production of different hormones that elevate our blood pressure, build up our heart rate, tense up our muscles in anticipation of action and positive behavior. We are wired to do this. And sometimes that energy surge is experienced as butterflies in the stomach. The nervous system as a whole is activating and elevating, and there's a whole lot of nerves in that lining of our stomach. And those nerves are going to start firing, and that's going to create that butterfly feeling. But that doesn't necessarily indicate that something is wrong. It simply indicates that the body is elevating itself to give you the best possible chance of executing well. Unfortunately, people tend to interpret the presence of the stomach butterflies or the rapid heart rate as an indication that they're not prepared or that there's something amiss. But that's really just a matter of interpretation. You can interpret those same bodily sensations as excitement as opposed to nervousness or anxiety. You have to choose carefully in that situation.
We're talking to Nate Zinser, head of the Performance Psychology Program at the West Point Military Academy. He's with us today to talk about his new book. It's called The Confident Mind, A Battle-Tested Guide to Unshakable Performance. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there areas of your life that you're really confident in, areas where you deal with a lot of self-doubt? How do you get ready for times when you have to perform under pressure? What questions do you have about how confidence works, how to build it, how to keep it up? That's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nate Zinser about his new book, The Confident Mind, A Battle-Tested Guide to Unshakable Performance. You can join in with your stories, experiences, or questions related to confidence at 800-642-1234. Did you ever have a teacher, a boss, a coach that built up your confidence? Or the opposite, one that gave you feedback in a way that made you less confident and made you do worse at your sport or job or task? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi, thanks, Rob. Now you just gave me a second one because I'm also a teacher. And I'm also very careful how you praise students. You always praise their effort, not their result. Because that's what ultimately leads to that confidence, is that good practice. This leads me into my question for the guest is, could you address the old adage of practice makes perfect? Because I was always told it's perfect practice leads to better performance.
Interesting questions. Nate, you talk in the book about the role of practice as it relates to confidence.
Absolutely. The old saying, practice makes perfect, has some validity in the real world. I do like the listener's qualification of that statement. I mean, practice for the sake of practice doesn't necessarily produce great results, but it's practice of the right things, practice with the right intensity, practice right at the edge of your present ability. That is what really makes valuable changes. There's a vast literature on something called deliberate practice, and it really is practice not just doing the things that you already know how to do well and are comfortable doing, but practicing things that are just a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit difficult, and that's what really stretches you.
Kevin, thanks for that call. And Nate, that practice, that deliberate practice, it's part of, going back to your definition of confidence, that sense of certainty about your ability that allows you to, in the book, you say, bypass conscious thought and execute unconsciously. And I think about that. I've been playing saxophone for years. I don't think I'm going to play an A and then a C and then do it. I've been playing drums for a couple years, and I very much have to think kick hat, snare hat. Like, I have to deliberately think. That's part of the combination of confidence and practice that brings us together to where we're just doing it without thinking about it.
Absolutely. If you practice deliberately a skill, saxophone, drums, any kind of movement activity that requires coordination of joints and timing, well, you are literally creating connections between networks of nerve cells in your brain, in your spinal cord, going right out to the actual muscles that have to contract in order to produce the movements. And that wiring, so to speak, has to get a lot of practice. It has to have those messages sent back and forth many, many times. And at some particular moment, and no one knows exactly when this is going to happen, that neural transmission network really becomes efficient. And that's when the movement suddenly feels natural. And you have this aha moment. Yes, I can play that particular piece. Yes, I can make that particular throw or catch that particular kind of cast. Because now my underlying neural networks have reached a certain level of sophistication.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Edward joins us next in Cedarburg. Edward, hi.
Hi. Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. You've kind of covered what I was going to say. It's like, you know, your guest was saying that these neural responses that happen, it's kind of like being in the zone. When, like, I sing sometimes, and when I'm performing a musical piece, and I feel really comfortable with that piece to the point where I don't really have to think about the next thing I'm going to do, then I get in the zone. And I didn't realize just how much of that is controlled by my body. I thought more of it was controlled by my mind. So he kind of just answered my question. It was really interesting.
Well, Edward, though, you gave us some really good examples there. That idea of a performer, in this case, being in the zone. Sometimes people use the phrase, you know, a flow or a flow state. Nate, how can we cultivate that? How could Edward cultivate that for his next performance?
Well, I think cultivating flow is really a matter of minimizing, dare I say, eliminating the mental habits that impede with flow in the first place. I am of the opinion, and so are many sports scientists, that we are actually designed as human beings to perform best in this somewhat unconscious, automatic, autonomic state where brain structures that are not required to sing a note or play a song or to even, let's get something much more serious, perform a heart transplant surgery. There's plenty of brain centers that are not required in that process. The brain centers that keep you wondering, am I doing this right? What could go wrong? All those little distracting voices, none of those are necessary. If we can get good at eliminating our tendencies, minimizing our tendencies to allow that voice to permeate, to take over, to hang around and hang around and hang around, well, then we find ourselves almost naturally in a zone or zone-like state. So I make it a process. I encourage people, don't try to get in the zone. Just make yourself zone-friendly or flow-friendly or flow-ready. Eliminate those mental tendencies that inhibit your automatic, natural performing capabilities.
Edward, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Nate Zinser about his new book, The Confident Mind, A Battle-Tested Guide to Unshakable Performance. Nate, I wanted to get your thought on training, whether it's at a workplace or a sports team, whatever it might be. I think a lot of training in America, in the U.S., is along the lines of, here are the things you're doing wrong. Stop doing those mistakes. First of all, how can that go wrong?
Well, if you overdo emphasis on problems and problems and problems, in a way you become more preoccupied with them, and it doesn't necessarily help you to improve. I mean, you can spend a lot of energy, you can put in a lot of effort, but in a way, that's like holding down the gas pedal and the brake pedal of your car at the same time. You'll make a lot of noise, you'll burn a lot of energy, but you won't necessarily get very far. The best coaches, the best trainers, are very good at identifying, okay, here's an improvement we want to make, and here's the positive step that will take us closer to it. And they communicate a sense of excitement about, if you do this, then you will be getting better, rather than, you're doing this wrong. You have to stop it. Let's change the narrative. Instead of stop doing X, we change to do Y. Because when you do Y, you're going to get closer to Z, and Z is what we want.
Now, this might strike some people as maybe touchy-feely, but there you are using it at West Point and on pro sports teams. And you say there's science that backs up that, yeah, that more positive way actually works better.
Absolutely. It does come across at times as soft science, but let's talk to the people who are commanding troops in ground combat. Let's talk to them about how they have been able to cope with the ultimately stressful human situation. And the number of cadets over the 29 years that I've been at West Point who have taken what they've learned in the process of becoming a good lacrosse player, wrestler, football player, and now they have to apply that same process of control of their thoughts so they can be in control of their emotions, so that they can execute properly. on the dangerous streets of Fallujah or in the hills of eastern Afghanistan.
Now, someone might be listening and thinking, okay, this may be all well and good for pro athletes, for, you know, top-ranked military members and athletic programs at West Point. Is this, are these confidence lessons useful for everyday normal folks?
That is the consensus that we have reached. I have been doing interviews on this book for the last couple of weeks, and everyone agrees, yes, this isn't just for people in quote-unquote high-stress or high-visibility situations. You know, every stay-at-home mom is under tremendous stress. Everybody working in an office under deadlines, that big pile of emails, that endless need to address your team's concerns and provide resources for them. We are all athletes in our own way. We are all striving for a particular prize, and that is what the word athlete really means, someone who contends for a prize. So these same skills can be beneficial to just about anybody in any walk of life or profession.
We'll leave it there. Nate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Nate Zinser. He's the director of the Performance Psychology Program at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He was with us today to talk about his new book, The Confident Mind, a battle-tested guide to unshakable performance. Still time for you to share your story of confidence or maybe overcoming limited confidence at some point in your professional career, school career, athletic career. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden is preparing U.S. troops for a possible deployment to Eastern Europe with fears of Russia's possible invasion of Ukraine. We'll take a look at that option and others on the table, as well as America's stake in the conflict. First, last fall, leaders and representatives from social media platforms, including Facebook, TikTok, Snapchat, and YouTube, all spent time on Capitol Hill taking questions from lawmakers around the negative impacts of their products on younger users. Congress also heard from a former Facebook data scientist, Francis Haugen, who blew the whistle about internal research showing the company knew its engagement-focused algorithms were harming children, among other socially destructive outcomes, especially on platforms like Instagram. Our next guest was raising these concerns 6 years ago in her book, American Girls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your or your children's social media use growing over the last few years? What effects have you seen in them or on yourself? If you were a teen girl over the last few years, if you are one now, what is Instagram in particular like for you? Does it cause stress, anxiety in your life? Do you feel like you grew out of it at some point? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Nancy Jo Sales is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and regular contributor to The Guardian. She's a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Nothing Personal, My Secret Life in the Dating App Inferno, and American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Nancy Jo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to go back to 2016. That's when your book came out. You were on this show actually talking about it. A lot of your book was based on conversations with teen girls about their social media use. What kind of things were you hearing from them back then?
Well, unfortunately, everything that they were telling me then is still a problem today. It was everything from addiction. They were reporting being unable to stop using the platforms, to the bullying and cyberbullying that they were experiencing, and the spilling over of cyberbullying into actual bullying in school. The platforms, as we now have confirmed, are designed to reward aggression, which is terrible for children. They were also telling me about the toxic environment of comparison, you know, comparing oneself to pictures of others. The exposure to things that they really were not able to handle at such a young age, including, you know, violence and pornographic imagery. I mean, it just really went on and on. The sort of things like, you know, just right at the time when you're sort of trying to develop yourself and find out who you are, this kind of creation of a fake self and a inauthentic self online. I mean, it just went on. And some of it was really disturbing, including, you know, I was really the first person to write about, I apologize to some of your listeners if this is uncomfortable, but there were and are these things called slut pages where nude, non-consensually nude images of girls would be shared on these pages, on Facebook, on Instagram. Parents typically knew nothing about it, knew nothing about the normalization of sexual harassment. It was just, you know, sexual harassment is just a sort of mode of talking. And it was a very, very controversial book at the time. It did get a lot of exposure, but it also got a lot of pushback from the tech companies, of course, from various people in the media, including some rather big media outlets who said that, you know, accused me of being a Luddite. You just don't get it. You know, you're raising a moral panic. Meanwhile, I was really just reporting what girls were telling me.
I want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Megan is with us in La Crosse. Megan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about Megan?
So I wanted to touch on deleting the Instagram application, actually. I deleted Instagram about 2 years ago, and I'm 21 years old. So for me to do that was kind of a lot because a lot of my friends, you know, use Instagram to connect. But I found that I was comparing myself a lot to people on Instagram, whether it was my peers or influencers. So my mental health was kind of declining in that way. So I just decided to delete it altogether, and I feel a lot better not having it in my life.
Megan, I want to ask, I think probably a lot of people in your position have considered getting off of Instagram, but worried that they're going to lose something. They would lose the positive contact with their circle of friends. They wouldn't keep up with what was going on. What was your experience when you deleted Instagram?
I really found it was kind of hard because a lot of my friends like to send me messages on there, like share posts with me on there. But after a while, I just kind of got used to it, to be honest, and I didn't really miss it at all.
Megan, thank you and your kitten for calling in. Thank you so much for sharing your experience. You found, when you wrote the book, Nancy Joe, and I think people have found since, that reluctance, that I feel like it's bad for me, but getting out of it would be bad for me, too. That's part of the addictive and compulsive nature you found.
Yeah, I think that, the platforms are designed to be addictive. They appeal to our neurological systems with these dopamine spikes you get through the likes. This was very much on purpose, that the way that they were constructed. And it is a very toxic thing to give people a product that you know is going to addict them, especially children. And I applaud anyone who has the ability to get off of these platforms and to say no. And I think that that is something that a lot of people say, it's impossible, we can't do it, you know. But I would just, you know, I would love you to read my book, but I would also love you to read a little book, and it's a very slim volume called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. And it's important to note who this book is by. It's by someone named Jaren Lanier, L-A-N-I-E-R, who is an internet genius. And he's one of the, pioneers of AI. And he himself has seen and has become very alarmed about the destructive nature of these platforms on our society.
Megan, thanks again for calling in at 800-642-1234, talking about the impact of Instagram and other social media, especially on teen girls. Nancy Jo Sales is with us, author of the book American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own experiences. Nancy Jo, you were saying a lot of pushback at the time when you wrote this book in 2016, especially, not exclusively, but especially from technology companies. Then last fall, we had this whistleblower information, a lot of data released to the Wall Street Journal, suggesting, showing that at least researchers within Facebook, owner of Instagram, knew this stuff was happening. What did you think as you started to see their own internal research coming out?
Well, it really looked to me like they were, I can't say this for a fact, but I do know that my book was one of the first to criticize this effect of these platforms on especially teenagers and children. And it all, with the timing of their internal research at Facebook, it almost looked like they read my book or they became aware of the critique that was suddenly going on in the media. I mean, it was, there was a lot written about it. And they said to them, I mean, I can't prove this, but it really looks like they said to themselves, timing wise, well, maybe let's find out if that's true. Are we doing this? You know, it's something that they probably should have asked before they ever launched these things. And in fact, so much of what my book was about was proven by their own internal research. I mean, what they discovered is really only a sliver of what my book is about. It's really just my book, I think, provides still to this day a much more comprehensive look at all of this. But they did see that they were contributing to negative body image among girls, even, I mean, my God, suicidal ideation. And yet they did not release this information. I think that probably, you know, I can't say for sure, but I guess their plan was to do some internal research and prove that I was wrong and that all of this critique was wrong. But they never released any of this data. They never released any of this information. They totally covered it up, which is why a whistleblower had to come along years later. This was 2017 when they did this. My book came out 2016. And reveal it, because they owed this knowledge to the public, because up until that point, there had actually been very little research done in the academic world and among, you know, social scientists. There's a lot now. There's a lot. Ever since my book came out, there's just like a deluge of research and information talking about anxiety, rising anxiety, rising depression, problems with loneliness, and again, the suicidal thoughts among children and teenagers who use these products, and adults too, but it affects kids more. But they swept it under the rug, you know, and the comparison has been made before, similarly to what the tobacco companies did when they knew that tobacco could kill you, cigarettes could kill you, and yet they just let people die.
We're talking to journalist and author Nancy Jo Sales. Her books include American Girls, Social Media, and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. We're talking about the impact of social media apps, the effects they have on young women and girls in particular, how they've changed in recent years. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a bad experience with Instagram or other social media platform? Are there regulations or restrictions you'd like to see, especially applying to young people for Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and more? Do you see the government having a role to play here? Do you want more transparency from the owners of these social media platforms? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about the impacts of apps like Instagram and Facebook on teenage girls. Nancy Jo Sales is with us, author of the book American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Came out in 2016, raising a lot of concerns. Concerns backed up with the leak of internal Facebook research last year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We learned from the whistleblower, Frances Haugen, about Facebook's internal research. I want to listen to an interview on 60 Minutes. She was asked about a couple of these internal studies. More than 13% of teen girls said Instagram made thoughts of suicide worse. 17% of teen girls said Instagram made eating disorders worse. Here's her response.
And what's super tragic is Facebook's own research says, as these young women begin to consume this eating disorder content, they get more and more depressed, and it actually makes them use the app more. And so they end up in this feedback cycle where they hate their bodies more and more. Facebook's own research says it is not just that Instagram is dangerous for teenagers, that it harms teenagers. is that it is distinctly worse than other forms of social media.
Well, with that cycle, that spiral of harm here, Nancy Jo, do you see any sense of urgency from Congress, from platforms themselves to do something about it?
No, there was a resounding silence when my book came out, and there doesn't seem to be any movement now. I mean, there are people, you know, they periodically haul Mark Zuckerberg before Congress to have an answer to these types of things. And by the way, it's not the only platform on which this is happening, Facebook and Instagram. These aren't the only ones. I teach at a college, and my students, some of my students, young women, were looking into TikTok and what's happening on there, and body image problems and pro eating disorder content are now on TikTok. So it's sort of proliferating everywhere. And are they really taking steps to do anything about it? Not that I have seen. In fact, Instagram came out, you know, right after the Frances Haugen revelations, Instagram came out with a just really pathetic solution, which was that they were going to periodically show users a message that said, hey, do you think you've been on here too long? Maybe take a break. I mean, that is the most cynical thing I can think of. You know, giving people essentially a drug, it's an addictive drug, and saying, hey, have you taken too much heroin? Maybe you want to put down the needle for a little while. I mean, like, that's like the dealer saying that to the user. It's just beyond hypocritical.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bob is with us in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking the call. This is a great topic. It's about 15 years too late, but I'm with you. I appreciate that your guest has written the book. I don't see it as particularly a huge revelation, but to people that are in the know. But to a lot of people, I think it is. The problem is, just when we need more wisdom and mediation, we got social media, which is neither social nor is it mediated. And it's a real problem because there's no wisdom imparted. There's no expertise to impart any sense of mediation in between users who may or may not know what the heck they're talking about. I've been telling my students for 15 years now, pretty much since the inception of the first social media platforms, to abstain from that because it will not end well. And, you know, maybe not exactly for the same reasons that your author is talking about, but the problem is it's not going to end by appealing to self-regulation. The people who run these companies are making billions of dollars by offering these things. And, you know, you can take it one step further and go to, like, say, hey, I get free email from Google. No, you don't. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
I gotcha. Bob, thanks for the call. Nancy Jo, he says, hey, abstain completely from social media. You mentioned a small book earlier recommending basically the same thing.
Well, I couldn't agree with your caller more in terms of what's really driving all this, which is money. The bottom line is the bottom line. And these tech companies tend to contribute to the campaigns of politicians on both sides of the aisle. I mean, when Trump was in office, Mark Zuckerberg was a friend of Trump. Now he's a friend of Biden. I mean, these guys will, and it mainly is guys who head these companies, they will do whatever they need to do to, you know, ensure their company's profits. And that's really what Frances Haugen confirmed for us, which is that, and I've heard this from, you know, people who reach out to me who work in tech companies too, sort of off the record. They say, look, we want things to change. We are in the ethics department. But every time we raise issues, they always come back to us with engagement. Engagement meaning how much users are on the platforms. The bottom line there is engagement. They just want eyeballs on their screens all the time. And it doesn't matter to them what the fallout is because the business model is use. They just want people using more, more, more. And that's cynical enough when you think about what it does to adults. But when you're talking about young minds, children, you know, and your caller is right also on this score, which is that the misinformation and the disinformation that one finds on Facebook, it's hard enough for adults to distinguish sometimes what's real and what's not. There's no sort of checking or vetting or filters, but it's almost impossible for kids.
Bob, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nancy Jo Sales about social media platforms, the impact they have on everyone, especially young women and girls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nancy Joe's the author of the book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Back to your calls now. Peggy is with us in Janesville. Peggy, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Nancy, for that book. I really appreciate that. I wanted to make a comment about TikTok. I was only on for a day or two and quickly realized how dangerous it was. It initially was very funny, and it degraded. The longer I was on it, the almost to pornographic levels. And I thought, well, TikTok is for young people, and how dangerous is that? And I was quite upset and, you know, deleted it. And it got real so bad. It just got so bad.
Peggy, thanks for that call. Nancy Joe, Peggy says she quickly found it was almost a pornographic site. Is that something you've encountered? You were talking about looking at TikTok with your students.
Well, this is, yeah, I mean, TikTok, even on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, there's pornography. And, you know, it was always so surprising to me that people would say that I was raised in a moral panic and that I was, you know, this kind of Miss Grundy, you know, strict school marm type who just didn't want the kids to have their fun. That is ridiculous. There's nothing that says that children should see pornography. I mean, anybody who thinks that, I just don't understand that. And there is no sort of, there's no sort of regulation or filter on any of this content, this pornographic content coming onto these screens. And parents often have no idea really what their children, and sometimes it's really young children, are seeing. I mean, I've interviewed 13-year-olds and younger even who have seen things that they really just shouldn't see. And it's on YouTube. And it's not because we're not quote-unquote sex positive. It's because we don't, you know, as a society, we actually have laws that say that children should not consume pornography. And yet they do, and they can on social media. So I agree with her.
Thanks for the call, Peggy. In just our last minute and a half, what solutions do you see? What kind of changes would you hope for at the top of your mind with these issues that go back to your book and beyond?
There has to be government regulation. I mean, there's government regulation of almost every industry to some extent. You know, like, industries shouldn't just be able to act willy-nilly and harm people. Once upon a time, there was no regulation of the meat industry. You know, and people were getting sick and dying. It's a problem. Really comes down to one particular law. That's this is a little wonky, but it's Section 230 of that aspect of internet law that was passed in the late 90s that says that what happens on these platforms, the tech companies cannot be held responsible for what third parties do. And that's really a problem, because that means that third parties, meaning users, anyone out there, can do anything, and these tech companies can never be sued. Well, if you're a company and you have a product, but you can never be sued for anything that happens with your product, then why are you ever, when the bottom line is the bottom line, why are you ever going to take responsibility?
Nancy Joe, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Nancy Joe Sales, contributing editor for Vanity Fair, author of the 2016 book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. We talked with her about what has and hasn't changed over the years and the ways that social media apps operate and influence teenage girls.